Blog Talk Radio.
Permit me to introduce myself. The name is Mr. Kick. I dwell in a dark dominion away down by the river Styx. The devil has sent me here because I'm full of wicked tricks. And I'm such a popular fellow among all you lunatics. A course in ruination from the devil's text. To fools who can't withstand temptation, step right up, you're next. I hail from a hollow hellhole down along the river Styx. Allow me to introduce myself. The name is Mr. Kicks. When an old wolf starts prowling out among the young lambs howling, don't you know he's looking for kicks? When a young cat full of sly tricks spends his evenings chasing fly chicks, 10 to 1 he's looking for kicks. Kicks is always in demand, cause kicks is full of fun and laughter. Lots of folks get out of hand because it's only kicks they're after. Shady lady and her lover operating undercover, she knows sin and virtue don't mix. Her mama raised a prim and proper, but now while her pills couldn't stop her when she's on a manhunt for kicks. Yeah, yeah, looking for kicks. Just kicks, nothing but kicks. I'm Satan's simple servant sent to get you in a fix. So look me up just anytime. Name is Mr. Kicks.
Hiya, boys and girls, and welcome to the Spirit of America Party and the Spirit of America Party book and radio show. Last we talked, we had covered Red Cocaine, chapter number 1. And we're going to go into chapter number 2. But first, I'm going to touch on the suffering that has taken place in Arizona. And how quick the left was to stigmatize Sarah Palin, which shows you how evil they are, man. They have no morals whatsoever. They have no qualms about upsetting people who are in pain. While a congresswoman lay on the operating table, the communists were planning to exploit the madness of a fellow communist. Blame and deflect are always a good communist tactic when they get caught. Today, the party of death is pretending to grieve for 9 Americans, but they never grieve for 1,200,000 Americans dissected in Democrat chop shops annually. It is their law, and you have no choice but to obey it. Chuck Schumer calls it settled law. Reinhard Heydrich called it the final solution. 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time was a moment of politically correct silence. Guy couldn't even say the word prayer. A moment of silence. Yeah, and this is the government that wants 24 hours of silence from people who protest being usurped. How about a prayer as each American is carried into their place of worship in a flag-draped coffin, just back from a war zone? We sneak those bodies back in. We don't even give them a moment of silence. When the Bolsheviks wrapped in the American flag that they voted to burn say, we need gun control, substitute the word gun with the word slave. Today they are using a congresswoman from New York whose husband was killed on a train with a gun. But the truth of the matter is, the guy who killed her husband was a black racist and was killing white people on that train. Should her legislation say, take the guns away from black racists? Oh no, that's not the goal. The real goal, masked in good intentions, is to destroy the Second Amendment, to imprison the hearts, souls, and minds of a people born in freedom, whether you got the gift in 1776 or in 1876. The 22-year-old lost cause who turned his weapon on a 9-year-old girl and a 76-year-old retiree was overpowered by a law-abiding citizen who was carrying a gun but decided he could overpower this nut job physically without the gun, along with two other heroes who held him down. Do you really want to confiscate that hero's gun because one nut or criminal used a gun to commit murder? How will we benefit? Do we want to load up on a simple statement with communist gibberish? When the mighty second already simply states that all Americans have the right to bear arms and don't have to be in a well-regulated militia. If the boys at Concord did not have rifles, where would you be today? In the words of Noah Webster, before a standing army can rule, the people must be disarmed, as they are in almost every kingdom of Europe. The supreme power in America cannot enforce unjust laws by the sword because the whole body of the people are armed and constitute a force superior to any band of regular troops that can be, on any pretense, raised in the United States. And the words of Obama saying one day he's going to have an army bigger than the American army scares me. And he knew what he was saying when he said it. The Constitution says a well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, comma, the right of people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And the left will tell you, well, only if you're in the militia. That's not what the Founding Fathers said. The Founding Fathers said a well-regulated militia is necessary for the security of a free state. But the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed by anybody. On guns, Patrick Henry asked, did you ever read of any revolution in a nation brought about by the punishment of those in power, inflicted by those who had no power at all? In other words, no gun, you lose. To quote a well-known communist, never let a good crisis go to waste. If the shooter was a Muslim or an illegal invader, the media would be showing cartoons right now. When they first tried to tie this rotten mind to the Tea Party, they said he made a speech in front of the American flag. That automatically makes him a right-winger. But they failed to tell you he burned the flag. That automatically makes him a Democrat. 40 days before 9/11, 48 senators voted to let the flag burn. They called it freedom of speech. And when they take your guns away, they will say, this is for your own protection. But it's really for theirs when 2 weeks later they come to take you away. Never forget, never can happen, happens all the time. And if you don't believe me, then you're entitled to a Trojan horse, and it's only a gift. So the next time Paul Revere rides through your town shouting to arms, I don't want to hear the reply, we can't, we can't. Anybody who sees footage of the Hungarian uprising knows what I'm talking about. In the words of the American fighting men of World War II, praise the Lord and pass the ammunition. Spirit of America Party radio show. If you Google the communist takeover of America, 45 goals, goal number 3 states, develop the illusion that total disarmament by the USA would be a demonstration of moral strength. God help us. Hang in there, and we'll give you a tune, and then we'll set up to read you chapter 2 of, I'm looking for this tune here, I got it, chapter 2 of Red Cocaine, the takedown of America. If you heard Savage tonight, you heard Donald Trump saying that the Chinese should have to pay an excise tax coming into the country of 25%. It's not a bad idea. When our tanks stop running, we're going to have to wait for the next ship to come in from China to get the spare parts. Oh, it sounds like it's not working. So we're going to give you its magic.
Why do I tell myself
these things that happen are already true? When in my heart I know the magic is my love for you. The song begins, you speak, and I hear violin. It's magic.
It's magic.
Dust of desert disguise and rust to nestle in your eyes. It's magic.
United States is 50%. What percentage of that 50% is drug-related? Chapter 1 was the Chinese drug offensive, and Mao Zedong began it in 1928, cultivating poppies. We're now going to Chapter 2, and it's entitled, The Soviets Decide to Compete. When China began waging war with narcotics and drugs in the late 1940s, its drug strategy was quickly identified. Shipments of drugs were seized and intelligence was collected, which identified the source as the People's Republic of China. Together with its trafficking routes, techniques, and eventually even the principal organizations behind production and distribution. In the case of the Soviet Union, intelligence on the operation was not immediately available, perhaps attesting to the care exercised by the Soviets in developing secure, covert marketing techniques before Moscow's own offensive was launched. As will be seen, the Soviet offensive was designed to be far more extensive than the Chinese operation, and one in place was intensified on almost a yearly basis. While the dubious distinction of initiating large-scale political war with drugs goes to the Chinese, it is the Soviets who have made trafficking the effective political warfare and intelligence weapon it has become. Accomplishing this almost without any recognition in the West of Soviet involvement. Not until 1968 did a source surface in the West who possessed a detailed knowledge about the Soviet drug offensive. Not until 1986 was any attention directed to his knowledge. The story that follows is the most comprehensive unveiling of that source's detailed knowledge of Soviet narcotics warfare. Maybe if we had classified it as narcotics warfare, people would have been more alert. The source in question is Jan Sagina, who defected from Czechoslovakia to the United States in February 1968. He was a major general, a member of the Central Committee, the National Assembly, and the Presidium and its party group, pretty much like the political lineup in the White House. He was also a member of the main political administration, its political bureau, and a member of the Administrative Organs Department. He was first secretary of the party at the Ministry of Defense, where he was also chief of staff and a member of the Minister's Collegium. His most important position was secretary of the powerful Defense Council, which was the top decision-making body in matters of defense, intelligence, foreign policy, and the economy. Sagina was a top-level decision-making party official. He regularly met with the highest officials in the Soviet Union and other communist countries. He was present during the inception, planning, and implementation of Soviet narcotics trafficking operations. The Soviet concept of using drugs and narcotics trafficking as a strategic operation, Sagina explains, emerged during the Korean War. During that conflict, the Chinese and North Koreans used drugs against U.S. military forces to undermine the effectiveness of both officers and enlisted men and raise revenue in the process. The Soviets were also assisting North Korea in that war, and it wasn't until Afghanistan that we exacted a price from the Soviets in blood. And all this time since World War II, they were bleeding us. And if you look at any pictures of everybody celebrating death to America in the Middle East, they've all got Soviet weaponry. North Korea in the war, albeit not in so obvious a manner as the Chinese. The war provided the Soviets with an opportunity to study the effectiveness of U.S. forces and equipment. Czechoslovak intelligence assisted the Soviets. As part of this intelligence mission, Czechoslovakia constructed a hospital in North Korea, ostensibly built to treat casualties. The real use of the hospital was a research facility in which Czechoslovak, Soviet, and North Korean doctors at the hospital experimented on U.S. and South Korean prisoners of war. The Czechoslovak official in charge of the Czechoslovak operations in North Korea was Colonel Rudolf Babka of Srebrenica, Sprava, which is ZS. The acronym is ZS, the Military Intelligence Administration of the Czechoslovak General Staff. Now, you see that? They set up a hospital in North Korea for the experimenting on POWs. How's that? Everybody thought they were up there healing people. Colonel Professor Dr. Dufek, a heart specialist, was in charge of the hospital. Sagina learned about the hospital and related activities directly from Colonel Babka and various reports, and from subsequent briefings that summarized the results of the experiments and used the results in studies of the strategic military potential of drug trafficking. One of the books I remember reading about the war in Korea is we didn't do too good in the war in Korea, and there was a book that I read, and I'm recalling from memory, which is 50 years ago, that one out of three Americans betrayed their buddy, or one out of five Americans betrayed their buddy, and one out of three died at the hands of a fellow American. while in captivity. And as a result of the findings in that book and the findings upon the troops coming home, the military instituted a code of military conduct that you had to memorize. I think there was like 10 rules. And that was a direct result of the problem they had with the failure of American troops to withstand the brainwashing of the Soviets and the Chinese and the North Koreans. That book's out there somewhere if you ever want to check it out. It's a heartbreaker. The experiments were justified as preparations for the next war. American and South Korean POWs were used as guinea pigs in chemical, biological warfare experiments and in physiological and psychological endurance tests and in testing the effectiveness of various mind-control drugs, which were used to make U.S. servicemen renounce America and speak of the benefits of the communist system. So that's part of that brainwashing system. And if they did it in Korea, you know they did it in Nam. To learn more about the biological and chemical makeup, and American politicians gave them a sanctuary in Hanoi to do it from, and Haiphong Harbor. To learn more about the biological and chemical makeup of American and South Korean soldiers, autopsies were performed on captured bodies and POWs who did not survive the various experiments. And during this activity, the Soviet doctors determined that an unusually high percentage of young U.S. soldiers had suffered cardiovascular damage, which they referred to as mini heart attacks. At the same time, a Soviet intelligence was studying Chinese drug trafficking, determining that the young U.S. servicemen were also the most prominent users of the harder drugs. The Soviet doctors noticed the correlation and hypothesized that one of the factors that probably contributed to the heart damage was drug abuse. News of the physically debilitating effect of the drugs captured the imagination of the Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev. Drug and narcotics trafficking, he reasoned, should be viewed as a strategic operation that would directly weaken the enemy rather than merely as a financial or intelligence tool. Accordingly, he ordered a joint military-civilian Soviet-Czechoslovak study to examine the total effects of drugs and narcotics trafficking on Western society. This included its effects on labor, productivity, education, the military, the ultimate target at the time, and its use in support of Soviet bloc intelligence operations. Nor was this study approached as a question of tactics or as simply an opportunity for exploitation. Do you remember when the Soviet Union fell and we ran in there to get all their documents? And I think the Winona Papers, was it, or the Verona Papers, came out as a result of all the intelligence, and it identified certain Soviet agents that were Americans, and it proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that they were communist spies. Up until that time, we were only guessing. I wonder if the first wave that went in to get those papers actually saved some necks that should have been chopped off. The narcotics potential was examined in the context of long-range strategy, costs and risks, benefits and payoffs, integration and coordination with other operations were all examined. Even the effects of drugs over several generations were analyzed by scientists from the Soviet Academy of Sciences. Here we are. We're looking to find a cure for cancer. These guys are looking to find a cure for Americanism. The conclusions of the study were that trafficking would be extremely effective, and the most vulnerable targets were the United States, Canada, France, and West Germany, and that the Soviets should capitalize on the opportunity. The study was approved by the Soviet Defense Council in late 1955 or early 1956. The principal guidance from the Defense Council in approving the action was to direct the planners to speed up the timetable of events, which was possible because of certain operational experience with narcotics that already existed within the Soviet bloc intelligence services, but about which the people who had prepared the basic plan were unaware. The plan was formally approved when the Soviets decided to begin narcotics trafficking against the so-called bourgeoisie, especially against the American capitalists, the main enemy. Moreover, the study materialized at a most propitious time for the communists, because simultaneously the Soviets, under Khrushchev's direction, were working hard to modernize the world revolutionary movement. Khrushchev believed the movement had grown stagnant under Stalin, and he wanted it rejuvenated to take advantage of new world conditions. Soviet strategy for revolutionary war is a global strategy. That's what Jimmy from Brooklyn says all the time. It's not the Soviets, it's world communism. Soviet narcotics strategy is a subcomponent of this global strategy and is best understood in this context. While the primary target of this activity is often thought to be the underdeveloped world, this is not the case. Soviet strategy and tactics were developed for the whole world, within which the most important sectors were the industrialized nations. And we're not industrialized anymore. We're down to a few industries. The two big industries today are porn, and what's the second one? Gambling. And the government's got its hands in both. They use freedom of speech to shock your eyes, and they use freedom of religion to take your money. And by the way, they're talking about going after all tax exemptions for religious groups. That's coming next. So render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's. Caesar's taking everything. He's even going to take the second collection. I wouldn't be surprised if IRS agents are posted at the doors of churches with cameras. While the primary target of this activity is often thought to be the underdeveloped world, this is not the case. Soviet strategy and tactics are developed for the whole world. The basic updated revolutionary strategy took shape in the years 1954 to 1956, as detailed by Sagina. There were five principal thrusts in the modernized strategy. First was enhanced training of leaders for the revolutionary movements, the civilian, military, and intelligence cadres. The founding of Patrice Lumumba University in Moscow was an example of one of the early measures taken to modernize a Soviet revolutionary leadership training. The second step was the actual training of terrorists, training for international terrorism, actually began undercover for the fight for liberation within the context of the Comintern's decolonization policy. The word national liberation was coined to replace revolutionary war movement as a two-way deception, to provide a nationalistic cover for what was basically an intelligence operation, and to provide a label that was semantically separated from the communist revolutionary war movement. The third step was international drug and narcotics trafficking. Drugs were incorporated into the strategy for waging revolutionary warfare as a political and intelligence weapon for deployment against bourgeois societies and as a mechanism for recruiting agents of influence around the world. This guy's got a ton of footnotes. There's a half a page of footnotes. The fourth step was to infiltrate organized crime and further to establish Soviet bloc-sponsored and controlled organized crime syndicates throughout the world. The fifth step was to plan and prepare for sabotage throughout the whole world. The network for this activity was to be in place by 1972. Because of the close association between organized crime and narcotics, the Soviet entry into organized crime deserves closer scrutiny. Moscow's decision on organized crime was made in 1955. It, too, was to be a global operation targeted against all countries, not just the U.S., although organized crime in the U.S., along with France, Great Britain, Germany, and Italy, were primary targets. The main reason for infiltrating organized crime was the Soviet belief that high-quality information on political corruption, money, and business, who they could get to, right? International relations, drug trafficking, and counterintelligence was to be found in organized crime. Who knows who's more vulnerable than the brothel owner or manager? The Soviets reasoned that if they could successfully infiltrate organized crime, they would acquire unusually promising scope for controlling many politicians. And we all seen that example of the senator in The Godfather. And don't think he was the only one. He was the imaginary one. They got some real ones. And would have access to the best information on drugs, money, weapons, and corruption of many kinds. A secondary motive was to use organized crime as a covert mechanism for distributing drugs. Money opens all doors. As in the case of drug trafficking, the Soviets put together study groups to analyze organized crime, to identify the main criminal groups, to develop a strategy and tactics for infiltrating the groups, to identify what people could be used to promote infiltration, and to examine the possibility for organizing and help to organize new criminal franchises. In Czechoslovakia, the studies went on for 6 months. These studies were not taken lightly. On the contrary, they were high-level operations involving top officials from military intelligence, counterintelligence, civilian intelligence, and the administrative organs, the Department of the Central Committee. Can you imagine what it would be like in a Soviet country where everybody's watching everybody? The first plan was put into action in 1956. See how far back this goes? Czechoslovakia, what is that? What do the Chinese call it? Death by a thousand cuts? Czechoslovakia was given directions on which operations to undertake as part of the intelligence plan, but was reviewed and approved in the fall of that year. The plan instructed Czechoslovak strategic intelligence to infiltrate 17 different organized crime groups, as well as the mafia in France, Italy, Austria, Latin America, and Germany. The Italian Communist Party was used heavily in the infiltration operation. 20% of the Italian police were members of the Communist Party at the time in 1956. These members helped Soviet bloc intelligence agents. By the way, did you know there's 100 socialists in the Congress right now, and they're listed on the socialist register by name? Well, that's not the same as a communist. No, it's as close as you can get without going to jail. These members helped Soviet bloc intelligence agents to infiltrate the mafia. War criminals, especially Germans, were also coerced into assisting the Soviet bloc agents in this endeavor, especially throughout Latin America. How's that? The Czechoslovak operation was very successful and did not cost much money. Organized criminal activity was developed around information collection and blackmail. It was a two-sided operation. Once inside, the agents remained largely passive. They just collected information. Then at the right opportunity, information would be released for political reasons, like Wikipedia. For example, to trigger revolutionary changes. Who got that to a gay private? Another gay guy? Or to create a situation that could be exploited by the social Democrats. That is why the operation was organized. Within the unit responsible for strategic intelligence, it was used for strategic advantage. Narcotics, terrorism, and organized crime were coordinated and used together in a complementary fashion. I'm wondering about a guy that got thrown into a dumpster in Washington. What message are we supposed to get from that? Who is sending the message? And now there's a woman who was found murdered and in a car on fire in Washington, D.C., and she's also in government. Organized crime was used to control the elite. All three strands were long-range strategic operations, and all three had been incorporated into Soviet bloc planning by 1956. Before actual narcotics trafficking could begin, several preparatory measures were required, the two most important of which were the development of a strategy for the covert marketing of drugs and narcotics, and the training of individual intelligence cadres. The Soviets wanted to hide their operation from the Chinese, and especially from the West, to avoid upsetting acceptance by the West of the Soviet strategy, peaceful coexistence. Because the narcotic strategy was new in most of its particulars, the necessary intelligence skills had to be developed and passed to agents. This training activity involved not only Soviets, but East European intelligence agents as well. Additionally, during the late 50s, a research program was undertaken to obtain quantitative data on the actual effects of different drugs on soldiers, which involved the use of Soviet soldiers as guinea pigs. As part of this research, an espionage program was initiated to penetrate Western medical and science centers, especially those of a military nature, to determine how much the West knew about the drugs and the effects on people, particularly their effects on military combat effectiveness and decision-making. In parallel, a Soviet bloc intelligence services were directed to learn how much Western intelligence services about the drug business, in which drug groups that had infiltrated. One of the important questions addressed in this study was an effectiveness of Western intelligence services' ability to monitor the production and distribution of drugs. Several years later, Shajina was to learn the results of this study directly from the chief of the Soviet General Staff, Marshal of the Soviet Union, Matvey Sakharov. Zakharov said that the Soviet intelligence had concluded that U.S. intelligence and counterintelligence were blind. See, nothing's changed. And that this made the Soviet drug operation much easier. The United States intelligence operations were concentrated along those of the British on narcotics trafficking through Thailand and Hong Kong, where there was so much drug activity and associated corruption that no useful information on Soviet drug trafficking could be collected. The background noise was simply too great. Hang in there. I'm going to take a break and give you a tune. We'll be right back. During the studies, the use of narcotics and drugs became recognized as a special dimension of chemical warfare. In Czechoslovakia, drugs and narcotics research were formally added to military planning as a dimension of chemical warfare research. This research included tests on the effects of drugs on military performance, for example, on pilot performance, which was studied at the Health Administration of Rear Services and the Health Institutes of the Air Force. Finally, the basic study on the impact on the drugs on the West was expanded to improve identification of groups and regions to be targeted. The further study was the responsibility of the International Foreign Department of the Central Committee, Communist Party of the Soviet Union. It was, in effect, a political market analysis and marketing technique study. One of the last measures to be initiated before the actual mass trafficking operation began was the establishment of training centers for drug traffickers. In the case of Czechoslovakia, the training centers were joint Soviet-Czechoslovak operations. They were both civilian intelligence-managed training centers, which were jointly planned by KGB officials and Czechoslovak officials from the second administration of the Ministry of Interior. These plans were developed in 1959, as General Sugina recalls, and the Defense Council's review of the plans and a decision to fund them following instructions from the Soviet Defense Council. The training center was located at Petrovska, a suburb of Bratislava, situated on the Austrian border. The second administration training center was located next to Liberec on the western German border. Each course consisted of 3 months of intensive training, while indoctrination in Marxism-Leninism was present. The emphasis was strictly on the drug business. The Soviets provided the Czechs with a copy of the Soviet schedule and lesson plans, which the Czechs copied. The course included instruction in 1. The nature of the drug business, types and quality, means of production, organization of distribution, drug markets and buyers, security, infiltration of existing production networks, how to use the experience of intelligence networks, communications within drug organizations, how to pass intelligence information, and how to recruit intelligent sources. At the Z centers, two different groups were processed for training, and these alternated. The first group was recruited by the military. This group was strictly for drug criminals. The attendees were neither communist nor ideologically motivated. The word criminals is shown here in quotation marks because that is what training was to produce. However, all recruits were carefully screened by military or civilian counterintelligence to make sure that the recruits were clean. That is, that they did not have criminal records or a background in corruption that rendered them susceptible to blackmail by another party. Often the recruits were sons or daughters of people in positions of power. These people and the potential risks that would be associated with their recruitment were often the subject of specific discussions within the Czech Defense Council. The second group were people recommended by the first secretaries of the various foreign communist parties. These were communists who were considered loyal to the cause. They, too, were carefully screened by military or civilian counterintelligence before being admitted to the course. And here we got a guy, a Muslim that went crazy at Fort Hood, Texas, in the name of Allah, and nobody screened him. Their training was slightly different because their trafficking was also intended to serve a local political purpose and because they operated and communicated through different special channels. These drug trafficking was heavily oriented to support the first secretary of the local communist parties, for example, to compromise opposition leaders. In addition to Czechoslovak instructors, they provided 2 instructors for each course who had practical experience. Most of these were Latin Americans or others who looked the part and spoke fluent Spanish. These instructors would present seminars dealing with practical problems and real-life experiences. As indicated above, the courses ran for 3 months, thus a total of 4 groups trained each year. The first group to take the Z's course in Czechoslovakia was small. 7 future drug criminals consisting of 4 Latin Americans, 2 West Germans, 1 Italian or French national, as Sagina recalls. By 1964, the group size had expanded to 14, and by the end of the 60s, full capacity, 20, was reached. Thus, a total of approximately 30 students were trained in the first year. And by 1968, the annual output of graduates had reached 80. The second administration was of similar size, additionally similar drug trafficking training centers that Sagina was aware of were established in Bulgaria, East Germany, and the Soviet Union. And in 1962 to 63, Czechoslovakia was directed by the Soviets to assist North Korea, North Vietnam, and Cuba to establish training centers. On the unreliable assumption that each training center was the minimum size, each operated at or near its capacity, and no other centers existed or were added after Sagina left. The number of graduates today would exceed 25,000. The students who attended the course under Czechoslovak centers were mainly from Latin America, Western Europe, parts of the Middle East, Canada, and the United States. Bulgaria's focus was on the Middle East and Southwest Asia, Turkey, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Lebanon, and Syria. East Germany handled West Europeans and Scandinavians, and all countries assisted with nationals from the Far East. The course was free, all expenses paid, graduates returned to their respective countries and applied their skills. Some built independent operations, others cooperated with ongoing operations. Those who deviated and attempted to change sides were killed. All returned a percentage of their earnings to the Soviets directly, which would then reimburse the intelligence service of the satellites that had performed the training. In the case of Czechoslovakia, their cut was 30% of the fees the Soviets received back. The establishment of these training centers completed the preparations for the drug strategy. These activities, as strategy development, training, research, espionage, and market analysis, was the principal activities of the early Soviet drugs offensive in the late 50s. Where there were intelligence operations involving actual trafficking, these were more in the nature of limited probes, tests, and continuations of prior intelligence practices. The real trafficking, from Sagina's perspective, did not begin until 1960, by which time the marketing strategy had been worked out, strategic intelligence agents had been trained, and training schools were turning out indigenous graduate drug traffickers. Then there's 2 pages of footnotes. And we've got 11 minutes left, and that is the end of Chapter 2, Red Cocaine. Now, if you look at the 60s, that's when we really started to see an influx of drugs, and they came in nice and easy, and everybody was quick to experiment. That whole generation was an experimental generation, and many of them died in their experiments or fried their brains. Chapter 3 is going to be the Latin American drug network. I'll give you a tune, we'll take a break, I'll come back, and maybe I'll start Chapter 3. Hang in there.
Now you want someone
Basically, Chapter 2 tells you how they set up the network, how they train people. And you look back and you say, well, that's 1960s, you know. What has that got to do with today? I don't know what it has to do with today, but as we go along, I think we will find that there is a nice base that they have built up that exists today and still operates. Chapter 3 is building the Latin American drug network. Now, the Czechoslovak component of the Soviet drug offensive began in 1960 on two fronts: Asia, that's Indonesia, India, and Burma, and Latin America, Cuba. Because of the special relevance of Cuba to the growth in illegal drugs and narcotics in the USA, the Soviet Czechoslovak Cuban operation deserves close scrutiny. In the summer of 1960, just a year and a half after Fidel Castro seized power, he did it in like 58, the later part of 58, and by 1962 he had missiles in Cuba aimed at the United States. In the late summer of 60, just a year and a half after Fidel Castro seized power, his brother Raul Castro visited Czechoslovakia in search of military aid and assistance. At that time, Fidel and the Soviets had distrusted each other, which is why the Cubans first approached Czechoslovakia rather than the Soviet Union. I didn't know that. Sergina was responsible for receiving the Cuban delegation and serving as their host during their visit. One of his first actions was to arrange for Raul to visit the Soviet Union and meet Khrushchev. Following that visit, the Soviets directed Czechoslovakia to work with the Cubans and pave the way for an eventual Soviet takeover of Cuba. The Soviets wanted Czechoslovakia to take the lead, hiding the role of the Soviet Union. They did not want Fidel Castro to be aware of the Soviet operation to infiltrate and take over Cuba, and they did not want the United States to be alerted to what would be happening. Cuba and Czechoslovakia signed an agreement whereby the Czechoslovaks would help the Cubans obtain military equipment, train the Cubans in military planning and operations, and help organize Cuban intelligence and counterintelligence. In return, Cuba agreed to become a revolutionary center in the West and allow Czechoslovakia to establish an intelligence station in Cuba. 16 Czechoslovak advisors went to Cuba to provide training and help establish their intelligence and counterintelligence operations. Roughly 50% of the Czechoslovak advisors and intelligence agents who went to Cuba were actually Soviets operating under Czechoslovak cover. Within 3 years, all Czechoslovaks in key positions would be replaced by Soviets. Thus, from the beginning, Cuban intelligence and military structures were heavily influenced by the Soviets. In less than 10 years, the Soviets were in complete control. After the first Cubans had been trained as intelligence agents, they received their first directions from Moscow via Czechoslovakia to infiltrate the USA and all Latin American countries and to produce and distribute drugs and narcotics into the United States. And again, the goal is to take the money, just like the Chinese are taking it through industry. And they were assisted by a lot of Trojan horses in the House and the Senate on both parties' sides. Money does not differentiate. The instructions from the Soviet Defense Council went to the Czechoslovak Defense Council and then to Cuba. Czechoslovak advisors helped the Cubans initiate the production of drugs and narcotics as a matter of the highest priority and also assisted them in setting up transportation routes through Mexico and Canada, where the Czechoslovaks had good agent networks, into the United States. Rudolf Barak, the Czechoslovak Minister of Interior, and as such the head of civilian intelligence, personally helped establish the Cuban operation. From the beginning, Barak was constantly pushing the Soviets to go faster and farther. He wanted to speed production and make more effective use of the Czechoslovak agent networks in Latin America, Asia, Austria, and West Germany. No sooner had the basic Cuban drug production and trafficking operations started up than instructions were received from the Soviet Defense Council to expand the offensive intelligence to infiltrate existing drug operations in Latin America and the USA, and to prepare the base for recruiting these independent operations. The order was presented to the Czech Defense Council by the Ministers of Defense and Interior, as Secretary of the Czech Defense Council, Sugino was responsible for coordinating and scheduling such directions and subsequent assignments. The Czechoslovakian plan to implement the order had been coordinated and approved by the Soviet Administration Organs Department of the Central Committee of the CPSU. The main objective of the infiltration was to obtain information on individuals who had been corrupted by drugs and narcotics trafficking. Key target groups that were identified were the military, police, government, politics, religions, and business. Additional targets were scientific institutions, military industry, and universities. I'm coming down to the two-minute warning. Did you enjoy the football games this weekend? They were pretty good. Next weekend looks like it's going to be good, too. I'm going to leave you with a tune. When we come back, we'll talk red cocaine, building up the Latin American drug network.
Is a long, long time. far beyond forever, you'll be mine. I know I never lived before, and my heart is very sure, no one else could love you more. Love you more.